chasing rainbows in the sky. It's my invitation. Let's up take a trip on my ecstasy. I'm Mr. Bad Guy. Yes, I'm everybody's Mr. Bad Guy. Can't you see I'm Mr. Mercury?
Well, hello, fellow podcast listener, and welcome to the latest episode of the Pop Culture Pub Podcast. I am your host. My name is Chris Lockhart. Joining me is my co-host in crime, Mr. Jason Roberts. How's it going, Jason?
I'm pretty good.
Excellent. And we have a special guest this evening. All the way from the Cave of Cool podcast, we have Mr. Michael Dean Jackson. How's it going, Michael?
Good, good. Just call me MD.
MD, excellent. So, MD, Stan Lee always had this saying that every comic book is someone's first comic book, right? So right. I kind of apply that to podcasts as well. So someone might be listening to this podcast for the first time. They don't know me. They don't know you. Like, we've mentioned the Cave of Cool several times on this podcast. Can you just give a quick rundown to the listeners of what the Cave of Cool podcast is and where they can find it?
Okay, well, I'm the producer and the co-host of This Week from the Cave of Cool, which is a podcast that accompanies the Calvin's Canadian Cave of Cool website, which you can find if you go to the Google and just type in Cave of Cool or Calvin's Canadian Cave of Cool, you'll find that. The podcast is a supplement to that, and we cover all of sorts of stuff in pop culture, current events. Calvin is a fixture on the internet. He's a madman. He's absolutely wonderful. His balloon juice is pure gold, and I have the honor of producing his podcast, which is a lot of fun. As for myself, I'm also an artist and a writer, and currently doing work for the Amazing Stories magazine.
Oh, okay, awesome. Yeah. No, I can tell you've been podcasting with Cal for a while because you're using some of his mannerisms,
right?
As you were describing the podcast, and I know this because I podcasted with him for several years, so I can hear Cal in your voice, which is awesome. But it's a great podcast, and I had the pleasure of being on the Stan Lee tribute episode. I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and that was a good episode.
Yeah, I don't want to toot my own horn or anything, just because I was on it. It was great. No, it was a good episode. It really was.
Well, you were the only one who had actually met Stan, so.
I guess there is that. But, I mean, the thing with Stan is everyone, he was like everyone's grandpa, even if you had never met him, right? Like, he was just a fixture with Marvel Comics. And Jason and I did a review of the Captain Marvel movie recently, and I loved the love and the homage they were paying to Stan in that movie, like with the opening credits and even just his cameo in that movie. I thought was great. Mm-hmm. But all right, well, for this episode, I know we've done this topic before, somewhere in the years of podcasting, I've done a bad guy episode. I know we've done this, but we're going to do this again, because it's a new year. And not just that, but I was listening to Mr. Bad Guy, the song by Freddie Mercury, and of course, when you listen to the song on YouTube or watch the video or whatever, there isn't an actual music video for it. So I was thinking, someone should make a music video, using bad guys, from pop culture, to that song, Mr. Bad Guy by Freddie Mercury. Mm-hmm. And then I can't do that because I'm not a video guy. I'm not on YouTube. I don't do that. So I'm doing the next best thing. So that song inspired this topic tonight, Mr. Bad Guy.
And Mr. Bad Guy.
And as we're going through, we're going to discuss some of the qualities that make a good bad guy. So I'm actually going to, when I edit this episode, I'm intending to use Mr. Bad Guy as an intro and an outro, that song, because it's a great song. I love that song. All right, well, let's start with the, because this is going to be a top five list, and we will be doing some honorable mentions as well. And generally, the way I've always done these top fives is we do it as a countdown. And this is, I think this is the first one we're doing for the Pop Culture Pub, so bear with us here. So let's start at number five. Who is Jason, who is number five on your list of your top five bad guys?
Top five? I would have to...
In the number five spot.
In the number five spot, okay. For some reason, I kept going with number one. Oh, goodness. I'm going to have to say probably the Shredder.
Excellent.
From Ninja Turtles. It's just something I grew up with, and I don't know, he was always my favorite, so...
Awesome. I was going to throw him on my list. He is on my honorable mentions. But, yeah, I always love the Shredder. He's such a cool villain. All right, Michael, number five on your list.
Well, actually, I didn't actually prepare a list, but I did write some names down. I'm just going to go through them.
Okay.
Actually, in my number five position, I'm going to actually go with an unusual choice, and that is Satan.
Okay.
Now, Satan has been the villain in a number of films, but I was thinking specifically Satan in The Exorcist, William Peter Blatty's novel, and the film by William Friedkin. And Satan, I've chosen him because there's a category of villain who is not really a single person, but an all-pervading force. It's in the same way that they say that a character like Dracula is a symbolic character. He symbolizes diseases. Satan sort of symbolizes this sort of vague evil in the world, and of course, when he does horrible things to this innocent little girl, Linda Blair, in the movie, and it's either Satan or one of his minions, Pazuzu or whatever he's called, but it's basically the idea is that Satan has possessed this little girl and is trying to take over the world, or do mischief in the world. I don't know why he's chosen Linda Blair to do this, but but he's terrifying. He as an all-pervading force. I mean, when The Exorcist first came out, of course, it absolutely terrified viewers. People were passing out in the theaters. They were afraid to go home. People would go home and put all the lights on. They were absolutely terrified of the idea of the devil. He's an effective villain in that he is not anything more than an idea. I mean, he is personified when she, spins her head around and throws up the pea soup. But
yeah,
the effectiveness of him as a villain is basically as a concept, as an idea, and it's one that gets under your skin and doesn't let you sleep at night. I guess in the same way, I should have included him too. Jaws, the shark, is the same thing. It's this pervading force that's personified in this terrifying beast. So yeah, that's most people would put him as number one, but I put him as number five, as Satan from The Exorcist.
Excellent. I actually saw Linda Blair one time at a convention a few years ago. My wife got her autograph and actually talked to her, I didn't talk to her, but my wife did, and my wife said one of the interesting things she took from talking to her was how little she actually remembers about making that movie because she was so young. But yeah, it's awesome that she's still going around to conventions and meeting people. And
yeah, you would have thought something like that would traumatize her, but I mean, obviously it wasn't her that was, special effects that made her head spin around, but walking down the stairs backwards, but
yeah, I always jokingly said that was, when I was growing up, that was like when I'd go wake my sister up, that's what I would encounter, because she's not a morning person. No, excellent choice. Number five on my list is, and there, he just kind of snuck in there, because of the fact that at the time of this recording, we are approaching the final season of Game of Thrones, and that is the Night King. Again, what you were saying about Satan, you know, like the Night King essentially is just a force of nature at this point. Like he's, you know, they're going into, what is it, season 8 of Game of Thrones, and I still don't know what this guy's end game is. Like, he's this ominous force. You know, he can bring people back from the dead, and they fight for him. So that's kind of frightening. He's the original White Walker. Mm-hmm. He can, you know, bring a dragon back from the dead and fly a dragon. He's never spoke a line of dialogue in the show ever. And he's, you know, with his dragon, tore down a piece of a wall of ice that's over, I want to say 700, no, it's got to be more than 700 feet, 7,000 feet? It's this giant wall of ice.
It's a big wall.
It's a big wall that was built 5,000 years prior, and, you know, supposedly it was made with the use of magic and giants and all this other incredible stuff. And he's tore it down, and now they're marching, you know, south, you know, and they're going to be going to war with, you know, the main characters of the series. And I still don't know what this guy's endgame is. I really don't know what he ultimately is hoping for, other than just to kill everybody for, you know. And one of the neat things, because they did a flashback scene with him a few seasons ago where you actually saw that he was just a normal guy and he was created by the Children of the Forest to, you know, essentially kill men, right? Because they were fighting a war with man and they were losing, so they captured a man and basically turned him into, you know, a killing machine that could create more killing machines to fight for them. And then they ended up turning on their creator. So it's that old trope of, you know, like you see it in Terminator, where the, you know, the machines turn against man. He's essentially like a machine. Mm-hmm. You know, he's this force of nature that was created to exterminate man, but he ended up turning on his creators as well. And, you know, he's existed for over 5,000 years at this point. And, you know, how are they going to stop him? You know, like, that's one of the mysteries going into this final season. And, you know, I just find him fascinating. Because, like I said...
Well, that's one of the reasons why he's more effective, is that he doesn't actually say anything. This is the one who...
Yeah.
He raises his arms and all the dead people suddenly walk, you know, stand up, right? That's that guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't say anything. He just sort of looks at you really meaningfully.
Yeah.
And menacingly. Well, and just does stuff. And you can ascribe all sorts of motivations to him. And honestly, with the last season of Game of Thrones, if the ending, you know, sort of comes up and says, "I just want to be loved" or something like that, it'll be just completely tearing it down. You know, he's built up such a big mystique. It's going to be a lot of work to try and make him live up to that.
Yeah. So this guy, you know, was created by the use of magic, and, you know, he was created, like I said, as a force of nature to fight man. So, you know, I just find that fascinating. And, yeah, like, with Game of Thrones, their use of zombies, I think, is the scariest use of zombies, because he essentially controls this army of dead people, zombies, but they do what he wants them to do. Mm-hmm. It's not like Walking Dead, where they're just walking around and just want to eat people, or you know, a Roger Corman film where they want to eat your brains. You know, they just... they do what he tells them to do. And I just find that scary. That's a scary concept.
Mm-hmm.
But, all right, well, let's move on to number 4. And Jason, number 4 on your list, sir.
That would be Mr. Freddy Krueger.
Nice.
That's another one I grew up with. I think I always enjoyed the level of sarcasm, especially in the later. I mean, he's always been dark and stuff, but the level of sarcasm and just the super dark humor that just kind of came along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, I don't know. I was, of all the horror icons, he was always my favorite. I think it's mostly just Robert Englund that I just really enjoy, but it's just that whole character and the idea behind him has always been extremely fascinating to me. So,
well, what did you think of the remake they did a few years back?
It's kind of a shame because I like that actor. I can't remember his name.
He plays Rorschach on Watchmen. Yeah.
It's like, I really enjoyed him in that. And I actually really enjoy him in a lot of his other roles. And I actually thought he did a good job. But I think it was like, no one can replace Robert.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like someone coming in and playing, you know, Ash from Army of Darkness. Like, no one can replace Bruce Campbell. It's one of those roles that are just, you know. But it's, I liked what he did. I think the movie, I not necessarily like the movie entirely and what they kind of went. I don't know. It seems like they started off with a good intention and then they'd lost it about 20 minutes in.
Yeah,
and they're just kind of like, all right, we're just going to go start killing everything. But
there was that Jackie Earle Haley who played him?
Yes.
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 Former child star.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, number four on your list.
Number four on my list, again, is a little strange. Actually, number four is HAL 9000 from 2001.
Nice.
But the thing is, though, my feelings about HAL 9000 is a very sympathetic character, you know, particularly, I mean, he's the favorite of all the computer programmers. Everyone knows the iconic scene where he sings Daisy and his voice is slowing down when he's having his brain pulled out. Yeah.
Yep.
But his villainy is interesting because his appearance, I mean, he's the helper. He starts out as the helper. He starts out as the bland, the sort of smooth-voiced character who is there to basically assist everyone.
Yep.
And he is so innocuous and so banal. But then he starts turning. And the interesting thing about HAL 9000 is that he has a very specific reason for it. He's arrived very logically at the reason for deciding to kill all of the members of the crew. And that's kind of a frightening thing. It's because, you know, he comes at it logically. He's fulfilling his mission, and he comes to the determination that the mission is far too important to allow human beings to jeopardize it. I mean, this is one of the greatest fears of our modern age, is that our machines will eventually rise up and destroy us. You know, everyone suspects that your computer is actually actively working against you, and then HAL 9000 is the embodiment of it. But with 2001, I think that there is another villain that most people don't recognize, and I don't think, you know, it's people don't recognize how really chilling this one character is, and that is Heywood Floyd, Dr. Floyd. In 2010, the sequel, Roy Scheider played him and turned him into a hero. He was a great guy. He you know, just wanted to, you know, do the right thing. If you look back at the original 2001, Heywood Floyd, as played by William Sylvester, is a very cold, very calculating guy, very in control. He seems like a hapless bureaucrat, but there's that scene where he sits down and talks to the Russian scientists. The Russian scientists bring up the idea that you know, look, we've heard rumors that there's a, you know, a flu or a you know, something's going on at the American moon base. And of course they put that cover story out because they don't want anyone to know what they found. And Floyd, you see this look on his face. And he has this guarded look, and he plays it absolutely so cool. And it's like, well, you know, he basically gives them a non-denial denial. What it effectively does is it reinforces the cover story and completely glosses over the fact that there's actually something else going on. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he's talking with the fellows in the moon bus, and he says, you know, I want to tell you guys, you're doing a really bang-up job. You guys are really doing a terrific job. And if you think about it, this is the bureaucrat who is playing this politics, and it's absolutely chilling if you think about it, that he's so banal, so reserved, so calm, and yet has absolutely no qualms about, you know, telling stories, cover stories, lying, covering up. He is the perfect, and you can sort of imagine him sort of giving the order to terminate someone's life. It would, if it were necessary. He's that sort of functionary, and it was probably his directives that led to the programming glitch, which caused HAL 9000 to come to his erroneous conclusion in the first place. So that was my number four, HAL 9000, and to a lesser degree, Haywood Floyd.
Excellent choices. Nice. I loved 2001, and I did like 2010. They changed the character and made Roy Scheider a good guy, and I was okay with that. I definitely see where you're coming from. The original intention, I think, for that character was he did what had to be done to accomplish the mission. And then it ended up driving Hal insane. Awesome choice. So number four on my list is Bob, otherwise known as Killer Bob.
From Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks, yeah.
Or
Mr. C from the new Twin Peaks, because he is in the body of the doppelganger, Agent Cooper.
Yes.
Who's known as Mr. C. He's just, one of them force of nature characters. And they actually explained it a little bit in the third season of Twin Peaks that came out a couple years ago, where he was, basically rage incarnate. He was born, or freed, I'm not exactly sure. Basically, when they started, detonating atomic bombs in Nevada, he was born or released because of that. And then, he possesses people and he kills and rapes and does terrible things. And, one of the interesting things about him, especially in the first couple seasons of Twin Peaks, because you knew he was the killer, but you didn't know who he was possessing. So it literally, the killer could be anybody, but it's Bob. It's that character. And the actor who played him, did such a phenomenal job, showing rage, whenever Leland, spoilers, whenever Leland Palmer would look into the mirror and see Bob looking back at him, it was a scary thing. Mm-hmm. And then, it was the series finale for many years up until they did the return a couple years ago. But when Agent Cooper smashes his face into the mirror and Bob's looking back at him and they're laughing, it's a WTF moment. It's like, oh my God, the hero of your story has become the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And what is he going to do next? And, we had to wait, over 25 years to find out what happened. But, I really liked the third season of Twin Peaks. Unfortunately, I think his name was Frank Silva.
Yes. He actually had died before the...
Yes.
The new season began.
So, and that was unfortunate, because I want to say he died in, 95. So he really, he passed away before, all this traction started for doing the third season, and he never got to see that. But I liked how they paid homage to him in the third season, and they used his stuff he had filmed for the new season, and they used there was one scene where Mr. C's looking into a mirror and you see his face, they do this animation thing where it morphs into Frank Silva's face for a second, and then morphs back. And, it was neat how they were able to do that. But unfortunately, he passed away. But still frightening. Still a frightening character.
I think you might be overstating it a bit when you say that the third season explained anything, because honestly, David Lynch doesn't explain a damn thing.
Yeah, no. Yeah,
he was more confused when it finished than when I started.
He definitely leaves it open to interpretation, because, like I said, when they did that episode in the third season where they go back to, you know, 1952 or whatever, when they're testing atomic bombs,
was absolutely brilliant.
Was it? No, I guess it was 1940s. It might have been before the end of World War II. I can't remember when that happened exactly, like what detonation it was. But then,
some of the most fantastic stuff committed to film. I mean, it's one of the most amazing episodes of a television series I've ever seen. It's mind blowing.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah. Like, yeah, and you know, was Bob born from that, or was he released from some, you know, realm or something? Like, like you said, like I kind of interpreted it one way, but it could have been interpreted in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point. You can interpret it anyway.
Yeah, and I love that about David Lynch. You know, I don't need everything explained to me. Some people do, but I love, you know, when it's open to your interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's go with number three. Jason, number three on your list, sir.
Oh, let's go. Goodness gracious. just trying to rack my brain through this. No, he's not really a bad guy. I was going to go with, like, Snape and stuff, but he wasn't really a bad guy.
No, he was...
He was kind of...
He ultimately was a good guy. Like, he was just... He had to do bad things because he was trying to get in with Voldemort.
Yeah.
Spoilers. Sorry.
No, jeez. I'll probably have to go with Jack Torrance.
Okay.
From The Shining.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's.
Are you talking about the movie or the book?
More or less the movie. I think it was.
We're talking Jack Nicholson.
Mostly Jack Nicholson there. Yeah. It's. I actually probably should just say Jack Nicholson because he's just creepy. But it's, I don't know, just the way he brought that character out, and just, I think it's really just his eyebrows, honestly, that just kind of, he's really good at being psychotic, and that character always, even when he was, like, normal, before he just went full-on bonkers in the movie, he was still creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I remember as a kid watching that, it was just like, he was just off from the get-go. And it's just, he just got worse. And I think after that bathroom scene, he just kind of lost all inch of reality there. So,
excellent, excellent choice.
And another Kubrick villain, yeah.
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 Michael, number three on your list.
Number three on my list is the Terminator.
Nice.
Now, because he combines the fear of the machines rising against us, but also that unstoppable force, and that's the thing that I did appreciate about the Terminator, and we're talking about the original Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger. This was the role that basically made him.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, well known at the, you know, he was an up and coming action star, but this was the film that really turned his career into high gear. And he was this unstoppable force, but the Terminator was the thing that's not going to stop. And that was the whole part of the dialogue, right? He's like, you know, he has no mercy. You can't reason with him. And he will not stop. And that was probably one of the most brilliant lines of dialogue in the script.
Yeah.
Because that perfectly encapsulated the character of the Terminator. I mean, you know, with the second one, of course, they turned him into a sympathetic character. They humanized him, so to speak. But in the original version, that absolutely relentless, unstoppable thing that is coming for you is absolutely terrifying. And you know, to a lesser degree, they turned it into the T-1000 in the sequel. And I'm told there are other sequels.
Mm.
I don't know, but yeah. You know, after Terminator 2. But for my money, the Terminator in the very first one is probably one of the most effective villains. Because he's not a villain. He has programming. He's doing what he has been told to do, and he's just not going to stop. It's like a rock rolling down towards you. There's absolutely not a thing you can do about it except run real fast, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, Linda Hamilton manages to destroy him in the factory in the end, and that's, you know, that incredible catharsis of surviving this incredible roller coaster. But that unstoppable force that was the Terminator. That was my number three.
Excellent. You guys have both mentioned two characters from my childhood that scared the crap out of me: Freddy Krueger and the Terminator. And like, I think I watched the Terminator, I think I was 5 years old when I first watched it. Right? It was one of the first. You know, grown up movies I ever watched, and I was so scared. Because as a kid, you're always told, you know, the police are there to protect you. You know, if you go to the police station, if, you know, something bad happens. And to see the Terminator kill an entire police station.
And of course, that's where that absolutely famous line comes from. He just takes a look, looks at all the defenses, and then leans in and says, "I'll be back."
Yeah.
And that's what he does.
Yeah, that absolutely scared me. Like you wouldn't believe it. You know, like how you were saying about how people would go home and turn their lights on after watching The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I felt with The Terminator. It's like, if I was walking at night, I was always looking for Arnold. You know, because is he coming to take us all out? You know, silly, but at the time I was, you know, 5 years old, I was scared.
I'm told that actually Arnold himself is actually not as impressive as the Terminator. I actually heard the science fiction author William Gibson, who created Cyberpunk, told me once that he met Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was in Hollywood with James Cameron, and he was in a restaurant, and he saw Schwarzenegger, and he turned to Cameron and said, and if you know William Gibson, you know he's very, very tall. Mm-hmm. And he turned to Cameron and he said, "You know that guy, if he were taller, he'd look exactly like Arnold Schwarzenegger." And of course, he comes over the table and said, "Hello, I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger."
I love William Gibson. I love it. I just about have every one of his books.
Yeah, he's a fun guy.
I have an honorable mention. I just want to throw this out here before I get to my number three, and that's Tony Todd as the Candyman.
Yep.
That's a good one.
And the reason why I say it's an honorable mention, because Michael was just talking about how meeting Arnold in real life isn't as scary as you would think. Tony Todd, I met him, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago. Number one, I don't think that man ages. He looks exactly the same. Like, they're talking about doing a reboot of Candyman, and they're saying, "Well, you know, we're going to get him in on a cameo." No, he could play the Candyman still, because he looks exactly the same. And not just that, the guy is buff. You know, like his arms are like pythons. Like honestly, like they could do a new Candyman movie with Tony Todd. He is absolutely ageless, I swear to God. Amazing.
And he's a fantastic actor.
He is. He really is. I think he's very underrated, but, you know, not to go off on a tangent, but, you know, like, The Visitor, it was an episode of Deep Space Nine, Season 4, where he played, you know, the older Jake Sisko. Mm-hmm. That episode tears me up every time.
That was the episode I was thinking of when I said he was a fantastic actor.
Oh, yeah.
That was a brilliant performance, yeah.
Brilliant performance. And, of course, he's always great as Kern. I love him as Kern.
Yes.
Yeah, I really wish they would have brought him back towards the end of Deep Space Nine. But anyway, again, I don't want to go to tangent town here. But number three on my list, again, I'm going to Game of Thrones. Because this is where qualities come in, and that is Tywin Lannister. Now, Tywin Lannister is played by Charles Dance, and he's such an amazing character and formidable, not just foe, but a formidable person. Like, he's formidable to his own family. Like, you know, he intimidates everyone. And he's, you know, he's very smart, and he's willing to do things that are not honorable for a greater good, aka the Red Wedding. You know, he set up his enemies at a wedding and they got slaughtered, you know, and he didn't care because he brought an end to the war. And yeah, again, spoilers, sorry, you know, any Game of Thrones people, you should be caught up at this point, but if you're not, I apologize. But, you know, like, he was just an amazing force, you know, and, you know, the backstory of Tywin is that, you know, he was born into the Lannister family, but his father was kind of, he was weak. He was a weak man. He had his faults. I think he drank, kept with prostitutes, that sort of thing. He was a weak person, and House Lannister suffered under his leadership. So when Tywin came of age, and, you know, he started setting things right, and he started making examples of people that, you know, owed the Lannisters money and so on and so forth, and he ended up becoming a very powerful person. He took over for his father when his father died, but he ended up becoming Hand of the King to Aerys Targaryen, the Mad King. He was the Hand for many years with him, and then he ended up, coming back as the Hand for Joffrey. And, you know, like I said, he's cold, he's calculating, he's willing to do terrible things if it's for the greater good.
Or a sister. Just saying.
Well, not his sister. Because you're thinking Jamie, right?
Oh, sorry, I was thinking.
Yeah, this is the dad. Yeah.
Tywin's the father.
Yeah,
yeah.
And Tywin is the. I don't know how you guys relate with your. You know, you can never win an argument with your dad.
Right.
Tywin is that personified.
Mm-hmm.
He's always right. You can never win an argument against him, and he's that frustration that Jaime and Cersei and all of those have with him. You almost feel that. It's almost palpable that you know, it's like anger you feel at your father that you just can't yeah. express, and you know, you can never win.
No.
Except
you can't.
That a spoiler, you know. Tyrion actually does, Tyrion actually does win eventually.
And so did Cersei. Right. Her last argument with her dad ended with her winning.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But it was unfortunately the last time she ever talked to him too.
So. That's hey. Well, there was a foreshadowing of what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Right.
That
was quite the death scene.
It was. Yep. But. And there's so much mystery, I think, still left with Tywin. Other than, you know, his wife dying, he blamed Tyrion for that. Mm-hmm. But there's this theory floating around, and I'm kind of interested to see if they do anything with it in the final season, that Tyrion isn't actually Tywin's son. He's actually the Mad King's son.
Oh, no, that would be interesting.
Well, there was apparently a room, because apparently, again, going off on tangent town here, Aerys Targaryen had a thing for Joanna Lannister, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was this rumor floating around that he basically forced himself onto her, mm-hmm. and everyone kept it quiet, because, you know, to call out the Mad King, you know, would be to invite your doom, right? And Tywin knew not to tick him off. And then at the same time, she ended up dying when she gave birth to Tyrion, right? So Tywin's always had this hate on for Tyrion, because I think he knows that that's not really his son.
Now that would be very interesting if that played out, because in the end you'd have three Targaryens.
Which
at the end vying for the throne,
which is what happened originally in the Aegon's conquest of Westeros 300 years before. It was three Targaryens mm-hmm. that took over the Seven Kingdoms. Yeah. So you would have that same thing happening here, right? Mm-hmm. Because Tywin, they kind of left it a little ambiguous. There's a few things that Tywin says. When he's getting into an argument one time with Tyrion, he says, I can't prove that you're not my son. So the god, the gods have cursed me to see you waddle around, wearing my sigil and blah, blah, blah. So he kind of says that. And then I think it might have been the same speech where he says, you know, how he wanted to take Tyrion as a baby out and walk him out into the ocean and let the waves wash him away.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He raised him as his own son because he's a Lannister. But just because he says he's a Lannister doesn't mean he's him, his son, because people may not realize Tywin married his cousin. Joanna, her maiden name is Lannister. So either way, Tywin's related to Tyrion, whether Tyrion's his son or his cousin.
Mm.
He does have Lannister blood inside of him.
Yeah.
So there's that, and then also the declaration on after Tyrion shoots him, and he says, "You're not my son," and then Tyrion mm-hmm. says, "I am your son," and then shoots him again.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of interested to see if they're going to go that road, because I know in the books they've alluded to it, mm-hmm. And they've subtly alluded to it on the show, but I'm interested to see how that works out.
Person yeah. Martin is taking him. Of course, he's probably having the HBO just finish out his last book because it's taken him so long. Just like,
well
yeah, that's when the Winds of Winter comes out, it'll just be one sentence. Well, you saw the show, didn't you?
Right.
Yeah. Well, the thing with George R. R. Martin though is he's since his last book, he's done two other Game of Thrones books, but they're not, you know,
in the yeah.
Like he did the History of Westeros, which is amazing. It's an amazing history book. And then he just did Fire and Blood, which is really good. I'm reading that right now.
Yeah, I got that for Christmas, and I just started that. So
yeah, I'm really enjoying it. But yeah, number three on my list is Tywin Lannister.
Good All choice. Right.
So number two, Jason, on your list, sir.
This one actually comes from one of my favorite holiday movies, and that would be Mr. Hans Gruber.
Nice.
So,
yes, as a holiday movie, yes, thank you.
Right? It was just, I don't know, me and my dad always had these series of movies that we would always watch. We always, you know, we had Home Alone, and then we also have the Christmas Vacation. We also had, you know, Die Hard 1 and 2. And, there was another one. I can't remember, but we would all sit down and we'd just watch them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of like, it's a tradition now. I have to watch Die Hard and Christmas Vacation throughout that holiday season. It has to be watched. And Hans Gruber has always been one of my favorites. Like, I love how he gets so annoyed with his henchmen. And it's just, he gets so annoyed with McClane, and but he just kind of goes through, he has that sarcastic wit about him, but at the same time, he's very cold and calculating, and he's able to, at the end of it, you know, he just fakes him out entirely throughout the whole thing, and, you know, it's just, he's just one of my favorites.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the best things about Hans Gruber as a character, is he comes on as this driven man. He, you know, when he comes on this first the screen, he's got all this manifestos and things mm-hmm. like that, and all this stuff, and he, you know, sort of includes this other group. He said, "I heard them. I read them in time." You know, and it's like, and that sort of tips you off. Is there something going on with this guy? There's some secret with this guy. And when the secret finally does come out, it's a reversal, and it's brilliant. You know, it's like, the truth is he's a thief. He wants the money. That's why he's doing it. And that's a reversal that's like very satisfying.
The whole terrorist act was just the facade, just because, you know, he's not even really into it. He's just like, whatever, I just want this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Excellent choice. Michael, number two on your list, sir.
Number two on my list is actually Wilson Fisk.
Nice.
From the Daredevil series. Nice. From the comic books, The Kingpin. For one thing, his physical size, I mean, he's imposing, particularly the way that he's drawn in the comic books. I mean, and I'm thinking particularly the way Bill Sienkiewicz represents him as this gigantic figure mm-hmm. with his tiny head. In the TV series Daredevil, Vincent D'Onofrio mm-hmm. inhabits that role in an absolutely fabulous way. And I'm thinking particularly of the third season and the final season, unfortunately, of Daredevil. Fisk is a villain that is incredibly intelligent, and he's always three or four steps ahead of the heroes and the viewers in some respects. And the thing I like about Fisk as a villain is that his aim, his goal, is basically the same as Daredevil's. Matt Murdock, the hero of the series. Mac Murdock is the good guy, but again, there's that dichotomy of he's using bad guy techniques to get his aim. And Fisk, of course, you know, is clearly a bad guy, but he's using the sort of good guy techniques in the same way, I suppose, that Al Capone, you know, was able to say, I'm just a businessman, you know, I'm a good guy, you know. Fisk wages a comprehensive PR war, particularly in the third season, where he absolutely destroys Matt Murdock and Daredevil, trying to completely reverse the whole idea of the villain and the hero, making Matt question, what is, you know, is he a hero? Is he doing the right thing? Is he doing what, you know, I mean, he says that they have the same stated goal to save the city. They want to preserve Hell's Kitchen, but, you know, where does the villainy come in? Is it what you do? Because Matt ends up doing a lot of these things as well. And you know, is it the way you're perceived? Is it the way the public perceives you? Because Wilson Fisk is, you know, wins at some point. And the thing that is, there's always the point where the heroes, like, for instance, Matt, especially in the third season, and again, spoiler alert, but he's following a lead. He thinks, I've got him. You know, I've got Fisk, I've got him. So he goes into the prison because he thinks he's get this information that the whole thing that led him to being led out of the prison was a setup, a fake. He goes into the prison because he thinks he's got him. And then while he's in there, he discovers that Fisk is actually two steps ahead of him, and he's put him in a trap.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of thing that you know, you think you're ahead of it, and then suddenly he's, you know, without even doing anything, without even appearing on the screen, Fisk has somehow managed to counter your move, and it's like playing chess against an absolutely brilliant opponent, except that the stakes are, you know, a lot higher, harder, and a lot bloodier. And yeah, the series does end in a very bloody fight, but yeah. So Wilson Fisk, and particularly the way that he's played by Vincent D'Onofrio, and you know, really would like to see D'Onofrio get into the movies,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Marvel right. movies, as the Kingpin, as Fisk, because just an amazing character, and this actor has nailed it.
Excellent. Yeah, no, and wasn't it season two when Matt goes in to talk to him? That's when it's, because I don't think it was revealed that Wilson knew who Matt Murdock, that was Daredevil, right, in season one?
I'm not sure whether it's season one or season two, but there's that point where he goes into the prison and threatens him.
And then he just starts beating him up, and mm-hmm. he knows that Matt's Daredevil.
Yeah.
He's figured
that's
it out.
That's when he's figured it out, yeah.
It was, I think that he didn't know it, and he had his suspicions, but he didn't fully know it in the season one. It wasn't until season two, I think, where he actually pieced everything together and got the information he needed while he was in prison.
And his entrance in season two, I mean, the first four episodes are basically about the Punisher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then once the Punisher, the trial of the Punisher happens, and then you know, you take several episodes before you finally introduce Fisk. And when he does come up, it's like worth the wait. You know, mm-hmm. it's like suddenly he's just there. It's like, I see you got my message. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent choice. All right. Number two on my list is the Cigarette Smoking Man.
Oh, that's a good X-Files. One. Oh, I love him.
Well, he was, you know, right there from the first episode. You know, he's smoking his cigarettes. You don't know what this guy's deal is. Mm-hmm. And then he gradually becomes more and more prominent to the point where it's revealed, again, spoilers, he's actually Mulder's biological father.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows of the existence of aliens. He works with aliens. You know, a person can call, like in the season two finale, a person calls him up, starts speaking German, and he understands exactly what he's saying. Mm. And then he starts talking German, which up until that point you had no idea that he could speak any other language.
Yeah.
Then they did the flashback episode where you find out he's the one that assassinated JFK. I think he assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. as well, if I remember correctly. And then, what else was there? Like, he's done so many terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's almost like the Darth Vader reveal, you know, where when Luke finds out that's his father, and we find out that Cigarette Smoking Man is Mulder's father.
Yeah.
You know, and they alluded to it for several seasons, and there was, you know, that episode where, you know, he meets Mulder's mom, and she slaps him across the face, and I never want, you know, I didn't want to see you ever again, and it's like, what's going on here? How does he know Mulder's mom? And then
knows her very well.
Yeah, and then yeah, he's you know, yeah, and the reveal, and then the fact that he's the father of Scully's kid. That reveal in the, you know, the most latest season, I thought was incredible. Yeah. You know, William B. Davis, amazing actor, great Canadian actor.
Yeah. Interesting thing about William B. Davis, just if I can interject.
Yep, absolutely.
Apparently, when he was first on the early episode of the pilot episode of The X-Files, he didn't have any lines.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually just meant to be there in the background.
Yep.
But they decided to focus on him, and you know, the way he smoked the cigarette and just sat there and did that. There was never any intention, apparently, of bringing him back. But everyone sort of said, "Who's that guy?" It's like, that character is, I got to know who that character is. And so that's why he became, you know, he wasn't originally supposed to be. William B. Davis teaches acting in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
One of his students was actually Lucy Lawless.
Oh, cool.
Yep. So, you know, I don't know if he taught her how to do the high kicks and the thing, but but he did teach her how to act. So you know, I don't know whether that makes him a great actor or a great acting teacher, but Lucy Lawless,
yeah. Yeah, no. Students. Yeah, because they never intended him to be like he was just like, like cigarette smoking man. He's just, you know, a bureaucrat in the background. And then they're like, yeah, we're going to bring him in. And then I think it was Chris Carter was like, he had no idea who he was, right, as an actor. And he's like, can he even act? Like, he didn't know if he was just an extra that they had hired just to do that one part, or if he could actually act. So they brought him in. And one of the interesting things with William B. Davis is he had actually quit smoking prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. So when he first did it, he was just smoking regular cigarettes and was like, one scene in one, well, I guess he was in two scenes in the first episode, but it's just the one scene where he's smoking and he's like, okay, and then it's no big deal. So then when they started bringing him back, he was having to smoke more, and then he's like, I can't do this, otherwise I'm going to actually start smoking for real. Yeah. So for most of the series, he's actually smoking herbal cigarettes. He's not actually smoking real cigarettes.
Yeah.
But, I loved him, and I loved, you know, the newest season that they did a couple, was it last year? Wasn't the greatest. Like, it wasn't, I think they finally killed him, you know, because this character has survived cancer, he's survived being pushed downstairs, he's survived a missile being fired at him, and him burning, right. Seemingly burning to death. Somehow he survived that, too. But in this last in his last episode, he got shot multiple times and ended up in the ocean. So I guess he could still be alive. You never know. He's one of those characters that just won't die.
Yeah.
But by the sounds of it, they're not making any more X-Files, so I guess he's dead at this point. But yeah, I always love that character. The Bare Naked Lady song, you know, where the line is, I hope the Smoky Man is in this one.
Yeah.
You know you made it when.
He's become an iconic character.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we have hit the number one mark. Jason, number one villain, or Mr. Bad Guy, or Mrs. Bad Guy, doesn't matter, on your list.
Hannibal Lecter.
Nice.
Yeah, it's
just the character, or is there a particular actor you prefer playing him, or?
I think it's just the character in general. I mean, Anthony Hopkins he's just one of those. I mean, there's Hannibal Rising, which was actually kind of, it was an interesting movie to kind of see the upbringing and everything, but it was, I don't know, it just that the main core trilogy there that was just kind of, it was weird because like Silence of the Lambs, he was kind of more of a background character and it was just very, well, it's Hannibal Lecter, he's just creepy. And then, you know, with actual Hannibal, it was just them going after him and it just, how he maneuvered through the public and just how he treated, like that whole scene when they're trying to get his fingerprint. And they just, cool. I don't know. He's just, the idea of him is just creepy in general. So.
Well, the, and the fear he instills.
Yeah.
You know, like the, like Silence of the Lambs, you know, the whole elevator thing.
You
know, like that still scares the crap out of me.
Because he's so intelligent. And he is three steps ahead of you.
And
you don't even realize it.
It's not even the fact that that he kills and eats people. It's the fact that he can outmaneuver everybody. It seems.
There's the character and then there's the actor who plays him. The character though is the one who has that quality. Because if you remember the movie Manhunter, which is based on Red Dragon, Lecter is in that movie. He's played by Brian Cox. And who's I mean, he's a good actor, but he's not, Anthony Hopkins.
No.
But there is that scene where he's, he's supposed to get a phone call in his prison cell, and he uses this trickery. He gets a big gum wrapper, and he basically makes an outgoing call. But the way he does it is so cool and so calculated, and that's the character. You know, it's the actor who plays him, and Brian does a great job, but... You know, it's just that it's the way the character is written that, you know, the fact that he's thought this through, he's three steps ahead, he's thought exactly, how do I have a phone that only receives calls, how do I hack that and make a call, you know, and that kind of thing is brilliant when you come to the character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was the TV series as well. I never actually watched it, but I hear it was good.
I watched the first season. I loved it. Like, the first season is very cool. I got into the second season, and then at some point, I lost track of it. Like, I started watching other shows, and I just kind of... I need to go back and just finish it, because there's,
I want to say... Is there four? I was going to say there's at least three, I think. But, yeah, no, it... I've never actually watched it, but I've heard good things.
I saw the first season. I haven't caught up with it. I think there is 2-3 seasons, but I never caught up with them. But the thing that got me when I was watching the first season was that I think it takes place in one town. It's all in Washington, and it's like, you know, I'm surprised people just don't move out of that town because there's just so many damn serial killers there.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, excellent choice, Michael. Number one on your list, sir.
Well, number one on my list is another Marvel villain, and of course that's Thanos. And I've chosen Thanos because he's in the public consciousness right now with, you know, the Avengers movies, Endgame coming out soon.
Is it the comic Thanos or the movie Thanos?
More the movie Thanos, and there's a specific reason for that, because, I mean, the comic book Thanos is... Thanos does what he does because he is obsessed with the character of death.
Yeah,
he loves death, and he will kill everyone in the world to prove death, to prove his love to death. Mm-hmm. Which is a motivation that it's like, that's a bit wacky. You know, I mean, sure, you'll do anything you want for the woman you love, but you know,
yeah.
And so he's always makes me think of that meatloaf song. I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that. But the movie Thanos has a little bit of a different motivation, and that's why he becomes a very interesting villain. One of the best villain, the most interesting villains to me are always ones that are the heroes of their stories. Your best villains aren't just the guys who, you know, twirl their mustache and rub their hands and cackle gleefully. The best villains are always ones who believe that they are the hero. Thanos absolutely does believe he is the hero of the universe. He believes that he is saving the universe. He needs the Infinity Gauntlet. This is what he does. He goes around to planets that are overpopulated or will soon be overpopulated or overrun the resources, and he balances everything out. And it's a harsh thing, but he believes that he is saving these planets. He sincerely believes he is saving the universe when he gathers all the Infinity Stones, does his snap, and wipes out half the population. And that is a chilling thing, because a lot of people, and I hear a lot of people, I read a lot of people on forums and on the internet, who say, you know what? I kind of get that. And when a villain can do that, when a villain's motivation can make you think, well, maybe that's not such a crazy idea. That's very chilling. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe people don't realize how they're empathizing with basically, I mean, he's this clearly a villain. He's clearly a bad guy. I mean, he kills his daughter, kills his own daughter that he loves. He is basically the psychopath. I mean, he has minions around him whom he will not hesitate to kill. He is, by all measures, he is a bad guy. And yet people are saying, well, you know, that I can sort of see his point of view. And that, for me, is a very effective villain. And when you start having debates about what would you do, you know, if you had the power, would you do that? What would you do? You know, and it's like, and he, in the end of Infinity War, he is victorious, and he is going to retire. There's that scene where he's basically sitting there watching the sunrise, and he has done exactly what he said he's going to do. And that is probably one of the most effective villains, because for him, he feels absolutely victorious. And when the second part comes out, and we're all waiting for it, you know, that situation gets dealt with or reversed or whatever they're going to do with it, or when he gets defeated, if he does, that's going to be a real, everyone's going to be watching that. And that's why I've chosen him, because he's in the public eye at the moment. Everyone knows who he is, and he's polarizing. He's a character who makes people think, makes people question. And that's, for me, one of the most effective villains that you can possibly have. So that's my number one.
Yeah. Excellent choice. He was on my honorable mentions. Definitely one of my first honorable mentions. The movie Thanos, because the comic book Thanos, I could get behind his motivations, but when it's like you're saying, when I was, you know, at work, you know, talking to non-comic book people, they're asking about the Avengers and, you know, like, who's Thanos, what's his motivation, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, of course, I didn't know that they had changed his motivations going into Infinity War. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, he sees death as being the most beautiful woman in the universe, and he wants to court her. He wants to be with her, and she demands that he, you know, he kills half the universe for her. And people kind of looked at me like, what?
Yeah.
You know, like, and I'm thinking, how are they going to do that in a movie and make it seem realistic? And then they totally, you know, didn't do that, and then they did the, you know, the overpopulation thing. And like you said, you actually kind of, he becomes almost a sympathetic villain, because it's like, wait a minute, he might be actually onto something here. Mm-hmm. You know, as crazy as it sounds, he's not entirely wrong for thinking the way he's thinking, because he lived it. Yeah. You know, he saw
and his world. You catch yourself feeling that way, and you think, wow, you know, what does it say about me? You know?
Yeah, right. But, I mean, yeah, like, he watched his world be destroyed, you know, destroy itself, and he had the solution, and he knew that it would work. And, yeah, the way the movie ends with, you know, the snap and, you know, certain superheroes not making it, and the shock of, you know, him, like you said, you know, looking at the sunrise or sunset, and, you know, gets a smile on his face, and then that's it. Like, I went and watched it one time with one of my coworkers, and he literally turned to me and said, "What the hell was that?" I'm like, "Pretty amazing, huh?" He's like, the bad guy won. Like, and it's absolutely amazing. I'm so excited for Endgame. I can't wait to see what happens. But number one on my list is, I had to go with the Star Trek route, and that is Gul Dukat.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm.
The reason why I go with Gul Dukat is he's the only captain in the Star Trek franchise that actually had, like, an arch nemesis. You know, people can say, well, Khan was kind of Kirk's arch nemesis, but not really, because they only ever met once, and then they battled
twice.
Well, they didn't actually, like, physically meet. They just talked on a view screen one time, and then they talked over a communicator another time. Other than that, they didn't, like, in that film, there's no you know, fist fight between, you know, Shatner and Montalban.
That's true. They are never in the same room together.
They're not. And actually, Ricardo Montalban, I believe he filmed all his scenes after Shatner had filmed all his. So they weren't even on the same set at the same time. So, yeah, like, whereas Gul Dukat, like, he was, you know, the commander of Terok Nor, which was the station before the Federation took it over. And he, you know, was, you know, led the occupation of Bajor for many years. He kind of came in, took it over. So, you know, he did a lot of terrible things to the Bajorans, but at the time he thought he was doing the right things, right? Like one of the characteristics of that makes it for a good bad guy is when they think that they're doing good, when they think that they're right in what they're doing. And Gul Dukat, you know, saw the Bajorans as being the inferior race, and, you know, his race was superior, and they had resources on their planet that they wanted and needed, and so they enslaved these people. And then eventually they're driven off, and he comes back as a recurring character. But as the seasons progress, he becomes even more and more evil. Like, he does terrible things, but he still thinks he's doing the right thing. You know, he still thinks he's right.
He even tells himself that he's oppressive when it comes to dealing with the Bajorans, you know. Mm-hmm. Even during the occupation, he was always, you know, the good guy, even though he was the face of the occupation.
Yeah, he brought in certain reforms to ease the burden on the Bajorans. So in his mind, he was saving lives, when in actuality, he might have spared some lives, but people were still being killed.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there was that episode, I can't remember what it's called. It's the one where him and Captain Sisko are trapped on the planet together. Well, they're not actually trapped. Dukat can actually, they can leave at any time, but he's making it seem like they're trapped there, so they can have it out, right? They can talk this through. And this is after his character had a mental breakdown over the death of his daughter.
Yeah.
So then that's when you really see the face of evil. Like, that's when he comes to the realization that, you know, I need to kill the Bajorans. I need to, you know, that's my destiny. And then all the last season, that's him leading up to that. Like, he's, you know, working with the Paul Wraiths, which is the, you know, the enemy of the prophets, which are the Bajoran gods, and he's getting all these, you know, powers and stuff lined up to basically bring on, you know, Armageddon onto Bajor. He basically wants to destroy the whole planet and all that, and Sisko has to stop him. Like, and Mark Alamo, that's the actor who plays him, he does such a good job, because he makes, again, Dukat kind of seems sympathetic, especially when his daughter dies and he has his little breakdown. You think, oh, well, he's, you know, he suffered this huge tragedy, you feel sorry for him, but then he's still evil. Like, he realizes, you know, that he has to do this.
And no matter how unsympathetic he tries to appear, he can never get rid of that smug, self-assured attitude. And that's something that Mark Alamo, you know, brought to the role, which is amazing. Even in the end, when he, the final season, that he actually becomes a Bajoran in order to effect his revenge against them, he just never loses that attitude of superiority, which makes people want to punch him.
That and
Sisko want to punch him.
And I loved, like, the arc, because, you know, as, you know, from season one through season, halfway through season five, he seems like he's turning a new leaf. Like, he's becoming, you know, he's doing good things. He's working with Sisko from time to time. And then he betrays them. He betrays them all and sells, you know, basically his people to the Dominion, so he can become the leader of the Cardassians. And, you know, he absolutely betrays them all. And then he tries to destroy, you know, Sisko and his own daughter and all them by blowing up the Bajoran sun. And he really becomes an evil person in the last few seasons. And I loved the dynamic between him and Sisko, Mark Alamo and Avery Brooks. Like, they really played well off of each other.
He hits all the bad guy notes. Actually, just there was that one episode written by Mark Zickrey, Beyond the Stars, where that episode where Sisko thinks that he's Benny, the science fiction writer. Mark Alamo has this small role. It's him and Jeffrey Combs. They play policemen.
Yep.
In the 1950s, you know, against Avery Brooks, so the black man in the 1950s, and there's these two white cops. And I think they're just as chilling there as they are when they play their when Alamo plays Gul Dukat. There's that scene. He's just playing this little character, this policeman, but this white cop, and it's frightening. It's just as chilling Alamo.
Yeah, it is when they're kicking him, when they knock Benny down, they start kicking him, and they start flashing back between the cop and Gul Dukat.
Yeah, but even just that scene where he's carrying the picture and they you know, they put his foot down on it, you know, that little encounter, and it's like it's you know, a lot of threat there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so before we wrap this up, let's go through some of our honorable mentions. The ones that didn't quite make our top five. And we'll just kind of do this as a lightning round. So, Jason, some of your honorable mentions.
Predator.
Excellent.
That's funny because... go ahead. I was just thinking the Xenomorph.
Oh, that's funny. Nice.
Yeah, the from the Alien. You know, that's, you know, again, an unstoppable force of nature.
All right. Well, so I'll
icky transformation thing.
I'll go with an alien threat, and that's the Borg.
Oh, nice.
You know, the Borg I'd say the earlier version of the Borg, like the Best of Both Worlds Borg. What made them most frightening was the fact that they wanted to take away everyone's individuality. They basically wanted to make you a drone and part of the collective consciousness. You know, the person that you are would cease to exist. You would become part of the Borg. And that, to me, that's frightening. All right, Jace, another honorable mention.
So I'd probably go with the Star Wars route and probably go with Darth Maul.
Nice.
I feel that he had so much, just like, I mean, later on in the animated series and stuff, you find out more about him, but when they first, like, introduced him in The Phantom Menace, it was just like, there's so much secrecy, and it just, he was always this dark character, and it was just formidable. It was just like so much power to him, but you knew nothing about him, and he just kept coming. And so it was just like, I really think they just kind of dropped the ball with him there, just like killing him off right away, you know. But
were you giddy when you saw Solo?
Oh, of course, yeah. It was me and my son were watching that, and then it was just kind of like when he popped up, but both of us just kind of like stood up and just kind of went like ooh, like just inaudible noises, just like pointing at the screen, just like what. So yeah.
Excellent. Michael, do you have another honorable mention?
Well, actually, I was considering being a little bit meta, and I was going to have Kevin Spacey be one of my villains, but he's not a not a fictional villain, but he's effectively become a very you know, and he is a villain. I mean, he, you know, he not just playing one, but just with the whole his career and that weird video that he did as Frank. It just, he, you know, again, he probably thinks in some way that he's the hero, but
he's one of those that I'm just so torn, because there's some movies that I absolutely love with him in it.
Yeah. Oh, the Usual Suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is absolutely a brilliant movie, and I, you know, I no matter what he does, you can't take away what's in that. But.
No. I mean, and then the Ref. I don't know if you saw that one.
I didn't see that one, no.
I had Dennis Leary in it and Kevin Spacey. It was actually...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was more of a holiday comedy type deal, kind of dark humor. But it was just... I don't know. It's definitely kind of torn on that whole thing. But yeah, sadly.
I got a couple I'm going to throw out there before we close up. The Red Skull.
Yep.
You know, evil incarnate. Like, he is literally the face of evil. And I love the fact, speaking of Infinity War, the fact that they brought him back. And it's not even Hugo Weaving playing him. I thought that was Hugo Weaving when I saw him.
I'm surprised to hear that. Who was it?
I can't remember the actor's name, but do you watch The Walking Dead?
I don't know.
Okay, well, there's an actor on there. He plays, what's his name? Aaron. I want to say his name's Aaron. But he does the Hugo Weaving voice. And, you know, the makeup, they made him look like the Red Skull. And, yeah, like, I honestly didn't know that wasn't Hugo Weaving.
I didn't know that either.
But he did.
Yeah,
he did an amazing job, and I really hope that... I'm very hopeful that they do another Captain America movie. I know they said that Chris Evans is done and he wants to move on, but I want another Cap movie with the Red Skull. So I'm hoping for... I got my fingers crossed for that one. And then last but not least on my honorable mentions is Dr. Zaius from the original Planet of the Apes. You know, the fact that... You know, he seems to know more than he lets on. He's, you know, giving people lobotomies. And, you know, to me, as a kid, that just scared the crap out of me. You know, especially...
And again, absolutely convinced that he is saving, that he knows what's best for the Planet of the Apes.
Yep. And again, it's kind of like the Thanos thing, like, where he's not entirely wrong. Because, like you said... At the end, you know, the Forbidden Zone was once a paradise, and your breed made a desert of it. So there's a reason why he wants to keep man down. There's a reason why he wants to let apes think that man is always, you know, is a wild animal, because he doesn't want them to rise up again, because he doesn't want them to destroy the planet, which they ultimately did. You know, it was Charlton Heston's character that, you know, spoilers. That blew up the Earth and in beneath the Planet of the Apes using a man-made device.
Yeah, and I mean the way that, you know, Heston carries on. I mean, there's even that point where it's like you can see, you know, it's like, yep, of course, you know, he's right. You know, man will do that, and the way Heston does is like just proves his point. You know, and of course the incredible voice of the actor Morris Evans behind the makeup.
Yeah,
just makes that character.
And you know, one of the chilling scenes is like when Taylor, you know, when they gather up all those humans in the hunt and he's looking for Landon, and he goes down there and you know, grabs Landon, and then he turns and you see he's got the lobotomy scar on his head, and then they show Dr. Zaius standing there, and you know he did that to him.
Yeah. Scared the piss out of me when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Like, I mean, the gorillas terrified me, like the hunt. And, you know, them, shooting humans and treating them like animals, like, you know, the way a hunter might treat a deer, you know, that scared me. But what scared me more was Dr. Zaius when he's, you know, literally cutting people's brains out and turning them into mindless, you know, humans. Like that scared me. But again, he wasn't entirely wrong, you know.
No.
But anyway, and that again, that's what makes a great villain, is when their motives aren't necessarily evil.
Yeah, you can actually see, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't agree with it, but no, I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah.
But, all right, well, I think this was a great episode, guys. Before we go, let's play that little game of where can we find you on the internet. So, Michael, where can we find you, sir?
Okay, well, I'm producer of This Week from the Cave of Cool, caveofcool.podbean.com. If you're on iTunes or on Spotify, just do a search for Cave of Cool, you'll find the podcast. mdjackson.artstation.com for my art. Again, done work for Amazing Stories and a lot of other publications. And former publisher of Dark Worlds Quarterly, which is still available. They're free. Dark Worlds Quarterly Magazine. Interesting scholarly articles. Absolutely free. go to darkworldsquarterly.gwthomas.org, and
nice.
And you can download. There's four issues before the magazine finally folded, but still lots of really good stuff in there.
Excellent. Jason, where can we find you, sir?
As usual, it's nerdylifemind.com. It's my own personal blog and also just kind of everyday adventures that I go on or my, you know, friends and I do. And then my Twitter handle is just iRoberts3.
Excellent. And for myself, you can check out my blog. It's at randomnerdness.blogspot.com. And I'm also on this podcast. And I'm also on Twitter and Facebook as ChrisLock1701. And this podcast is based on a group that I created on Facebook called the Pop Culture Pub. So if you want to join that group, just look it up and send a request, and I'm sure I'll approve it. All right. Well, on
to the Pop Culture Pub podcast. I'm still waiting for my drink.
On behalf of myself, Chris Lockhart, and my co-host, Mr. Jason Roberts, and I want to thank you, MD, Michael, for joining us this evening. Much appreciated.
And it was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank you, dear listener, for taking the time to listen to the Pop Culture Pub podcast. This was our Mr. Bad Guy episode, and we will see you in the not-too-distant future.
Mr. Bad Guy, can't you see? This is my destiny.